Court. We have two cases today. The first one is United States v. Johnson. Captain Castanian, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Captain Washburn, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Captain Samantha Castanian, and I, along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Abrams, represent the appellant, Specialist 3, Devin Johnson, in today's case. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court should remand Specialist Johnson's case to the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals for 3 main reasons. First, this court does not have authority to act on the firearm prohibition in the first endorsement under Article 67 C1B because this issue was neither raised nor acted upon by the Air Force Court. However, if the issue had been raised at the lower court, this court would have jurisdiction. Second, the Air Force Court would also have jurisdiction if the issue was raised under Article 66 D2 pursuant to United States versus Williams, an opinion that Specialist Johnson has yet to receive the benefit of. And finally, third, Specialist Johnson's conviction is unlawful following United States versus Mendoza, an issue this court can and should review. Turning to jurisdiction, this court has jurisdiction under Article 67 C1B to review the firearm endorsement the firearm prohibition in the staff judge advocate's endorsement because it is part of the entry of judgment.
I ask a question in that regard. On page 8 of your brief, you state, quote, because the CCA did not act upon the firearm bar at all, this court cannot exercise jurisdiction at this time. When you're using the word jurisdiction there, what do you mean by that?
The authority to act, Your Honor. In United States versus...
So when we think of jurisdiction, of course, at the beginning of your brief, you said we had jurisdiction to act here. And when we think of jurisdiction, we think of it as if we don't have it, full stop, we're not authorized to go further. Are you using the word jurisdiction there as being interchangeable with authority? What did you mean by the invocation of the word jurisdiction there?
Yes, Your Honor, as a shorthand for authority to act, because as Williams goes through, there's two separate but related parts to jurisdiction, the authority to review and the authority to act. This court has the authority to review Specialist Johnson's case because it granted review upon a showing of good cause, and the Air Force Court had jurisdiction to review it because he received a bad conduct discharge.
Can you point to any other cases we've had where we've said, you know, we don't have authority to act right now, but we're going to send this case back because we want to provide the appellant with the opportunity to essentially perfect his appeal. Where have we done that before?
Off the top of my head, no, Your Honor. However, this would be consistent with Griffith versus Kentucky, where new rules of substantive or procedural benefits have arisen while Specialist Johnson has been on direct appeal, especially at this court. The change in the law occurred while Specialist Johnson was pending either a grant or later the second grant order on different specified issues. And he hasn't been able to receive the benefit of United States versus Williams, which dictated that the Air Force Court would have jurisdiction under this procedural posture. Additionally, the change in Second Amendment jurisprudence provides good cause for why Specialist Johnson didn't raise this issue to the Air Force Court in the first place.
Is there an element of futility in remanding to the Air Force Court? Because I feel like they've been pretty clear that they don't believe that they have any authority to modify the Section 922 endorsement.
I would agree that the Air Force Court has been clear, but they have analyzed the issue under 66 D1 as opposed to 66 D2. Even following Williams, the Air Force Court has not looked at this issue under 66 D2. in reviewing the first issue in this case, whether this court has jurisdiction, this court has to look at whether or not the Air Force Court has jurisdiction and can analyze whether or not 66D2 provides authority for the Air Force Court to act upon the firearm prohibition. So ultimately, this would not be an act in futility because this court has to ultimately answer that jurisdictional question in answering whether or not this court has jurisdiction. And that goes back to looking at what 67C1B operates for this court. This court can modify or can review, act upon judgments by the military judge. Just like in Williams, the firearm prohibition is part of the judgment in the Air Force, in the Department of the Air Force.
But, if we look at all the text, there's a little more to it, right? It's not just a judgment, but it's a judgment as affirmed or set aside as incorrect in law by the CCA. And isn't the CCA going to turn around and say, we don't touch this, right? We just let this flow through. We don't touch it. We don't affirm it. We don't set it aside. We basically ignore it. So if they don't affirm it or set it aside, is it still within our authority to act?
Yes, Your Honor, because ultimately they can under 66D2. In other cases where this issue has been raised, for example, in a lot of the trailer park cases where the issue was raised to the Air Force Court did not provide relief by not looking at the issue. By not providing relief, they have acted upon whether or not they know it's under 66D2 or not. They have acted upon an error raised by the appellant that comes after entry of judgment.
That's sort of a novel interpretation of what they've done. Do you have any cases that would sort of support that argument?
Your Honor, the plain text of the statute supports that, because when we look at what the Air Force Court is doing, the Air Force Court is declining to provide relief. And when the appellants have raised this issue at the Air Force Court, and we can't use Specialist Johnson's case as an example because he didn't raise it, when they have raised it, the Air Force Court has refused to provide relief. And in not providing relief, they have acted under 66D2 in their discretion to not apply or to not provide appropriate relief for the issue that was raised. But it's 66D2 that gives them that authority to do so in the first place. The Air Force Court has never looked at this issue. They've never analyzed 66D2. And it's incumbent upon this court in looking at Article 67 and this court's jurisdiction whether 66D2 would provide the basis for jurisdiction. Because that's the only way this court would have jurisdiction under 67C1B, because it has to be acted upon by the Air Force Court in some manner. When we look at the entry of judgment in this case, the firearm prohibition is a part of it. It is required under Air Force regulation. It's required under RCM 1111 because that allows the Secretary of the Air Force to provide for additional information in the entry of judgment.
Counsel, on that point, could you respond to the government's focus on the words after the judgment was entered into the record? Because they seem to be saying, look, even if that's an error, it's not an error after the judgment. And I think in your reply brief, you had a complicated argument. Well, the error is not really the checkbox. It's sending the information to somebody else. But is that really something that could be acted on under D2?
It's both, Your Honor. It's a chain of events that starts with the checkbox in the endorsement. And that temporally, on the facts of this case, occurs after the entry of judgment. We can look at JA pages 26 and 27, where the military judge signs on January 20th, and the SJA notes on the endorsement the day after. That is clearly after the entry of judgment, despite it still being in the entry of judgment and required under Department of the Air Force regulations. The practical effect, and what we would call the injury when we're looking at the standing issue, is that when the entry of judgment is distributed and it goes into law enforcement channels and ultimately into NICS, that's when the harm occurs and the injury in fact.
Now, counsel, let's focus, though, on the entry of judgment being entered into the record, because I think the government's argument is even if the signatures were at different times, under 60C, not 60 paragraph C, but 60C, it's not entered into the judgment until everybody signed it, and that's when it's entered into the judgment. So that checkbox was already marked at the time. I mean, this is the government's argument, already marked at the time the judgment was entered into the judgment, into the record, I'm sorry. And therefore, there can be no relief under D2 because it just doesn't cover it.
Even if that's true, Your Honor, although we disagree it is, because it, in fact, does occur after the military judge has entered the judgment into the record by signing it. Because, and for support for that, we can look at how the Air Force simply does this process. It states under paragraph 13.38.3 in our instructions, 51201, that after the military judge enters the entry of judgment, then the staff judge advocate signs it and provides the firearm endorsement. So even if those are still happening at the same time, as the government argues, simultaneous, the harm and the error, when it's forwarded, becomes a reality, that Specialist Johnson can no longer purchase or possess firearms, and that is an infringement on his constitutional rights.
The government says that that's not processing, that has nothing to do with the court-martial proceeding. That's a collateral matter, but that's not processing the appeal of the court-martial, and that's what D2 is about.
It is processing the court-martial because of how the Air Force does this process. First of all, the processing the court-martial doesn't end until final action, which is under Article 67E, is when that final action occurs and the entire appeal process is over. If there's an error in that process that can be raised to the lower court, it is allowed to be raised under the plain language of Article 66D2. Even then, this is still part of the record of trial, and that's why it can be raised. Because it's contained in the record of trial, because it's contained in the endorsement, because it occurs after entry of judgment, the Air Force Court has jurisdiction, and this court has jurisdiction and authority to act upon the firearm prohibition and correct it. This all goes back to relief as well. How can both this court and the Air Force Court correct the entry of judgment? And it's already provided for in the rules for courts martial. RCM 1111 provides both this court and the Air Force Court the ability to correct any error in the entry of judgment. So Congress has provided a statutory basis for jurisdiction and authority to act, and has provided the means for relief and redress, which is critical, again, to standing. Looking at this all combined, this court would have had jurisdiction to act upon the first endorsement in this case. But because this issue wasn't raised, remand is appropriate in light of the good cause that Specialist Johnson did not have the ability, essentially, to raise this issue in the first place. That's because...
Now, part of your argument is that the endorsement is part of the entry of judgment. But the Air Force regulation refers to it being attached to. It doesn't say become a part of or be incorporated into. In a layperson's sense of attached to, it seems to be separate from. Do you want to address that point?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It's no different than in United States versus Williams. The STR, or Statement of Trial Results, is also attached to the entry of judgment. And that's the language that RCM 1111 uses. It looks from the face of Army records that it's incorporated into the entry of judgment. This is no different. It is included. It's an endorsement. The plain meaning of endorsement is a signature on the back of a document. This is part of the entry of judgment. It just happens after the military judge enters judgment under Article 60C. That provides this court the authority and the Air Force Court authority to act upon any error within it.
I was trying to jump in before somebody else asked, because I want to go back, because the chief tried to, we want to ensure conciseness, or at least I want to understand how you are differentiating jurisdiction versus authority to act. You have argued the court has jurisdiction under 67B. But then it's the issue of the authority to act. And I thought I just heard you say, in kind of doing a wrap-up, that we didn't even have jurisdiction. I think it's just you may be using these terms interchangeably. So you're arguing we have jurisdiction to hear the case, if for no other reason than because the CCA heard the case.
That's correct, Your Honor, under Article 67A, because this Court granted. Yes.
What our authority to act is grounded in 67C, and so, again, is it your position that we do have authority to act or we don't have authority to act in this instance with regards to the facts of Specialist Johnson?
In this instance, this Court does not have authority to act, Your Honor, because it wasn't raised below.
At the CCA, which gets me then to the third question, which is, if we do not have authority to act, then where is our authority to remand it?
Your Honor, it's in two places. First, because there's been a change in the law, both with Williams and Mendoza, and Mendoza is the most significant part of this, Your Honor, for why this case should be remanded, the benefit that Specialist Johnson should receive from the changes of the law is built into the constitutional process and direct appeal. A quote from Griffith versus Kentucky helps here, that failure to apply a newly declared constitutional rule to cases pending on direct review violates basic norms of constitutional adjudication. It would be on simply the fortunes of, for example, Mendoza himself and Casillas, that those two individuals would get the benefit of new rules and Specialist Johnson wouldn't. It's the same logic for why this Court has so many trailer cases for this case. All of those appellants received the benefit of the law.
Do they receive the benefit of the law if they didn't raise the issue, though? I mean, aren't those Supreme Court cases where they raised the issue and preserved it? The law was not in their favor when they first raised it, but it's not law of the case or anything else because the law changed.
Specialist Johnson should receive it in this case, Your Honor. As far as I'm aware, most of the appellants who are trailers to this case did raise the issue, but Specialist Johnson has good cause for why he did not raise the issue. Even if it's at maximum forfeited, that's something the Air Force Court can assess when looking at whether or not he gets appropriate relief under 66D2, because ultimately 66D2 is discretionary. And the Air Force Court can analyze this issue, whether or not it's forfeited, whether or not it's waived, but it's not, and then analyze whether or not appropriate relief should be given to him. And it's significant that this Court has granted review and can look at the issues before it, particularly Mendoza, and remand for that reason as well.
Counsel, the government questions whether there's any real remedy for appellant in this, because it's unlikely that we're going to enjoin the FBI from enforcing Section 922, or even if there was no indication in the judgment or the statement of trial results about Section 922, even if it just didn't exist at all, appellant's still going to be subject to all the same legal restrictions when this is all over, assuming the convictions are affirmed, as he would be otherwise. So what real remedy or relief can appellant get from this?
Your Honor, I see that my time is expired.
Please proceed.
Your Honor, I think there's two parts to that question. The first being that if it was never in the record, I don't think that there would be an ability to raise it under 66D2 because it would not be in the processing of the court-martial. There's nothing there, and there's nothing to remedy under either RCM 1111 or, if there's no authority because it's not in the entry of judgment, RCM 1112 to correct the record. So I think that is a separate problem. And the Air Force could change its policy tomorrow that it's not in the record. Putting that aside, there is relief in this case because it changes his legal status in that document. He would not be coded into NICS anymore, and that would allow him to pursue a firearm or possess and purchase a firearm from a federally licensed firearm dealer, which he cannot
except
do.
He'd still be violating the law. Right? I mean, just because if the network for the firearm dealers wasn't working properly, he would still be subject to Section 922, right?
He could be prosecuted, Your Honor, but by adjudicating the issue ultimately of whether or not the Second Amendment protects him because he's a nonviolent felon, it would be arguably impossible, but at least very difficult for a successful prosecution to occur because he did not have knowledge of his felon status under RAFE. And that's the distinguishing factor in this case for how relief is possible. He's no longer indexed in Nix, he can purchase a firearm, and then if he purchased a firearm, he could not be ultimately prosecuted successfully because he doesn't qualify as a felon. And it's the adjudication of all of those that makes it likely that a favorable ruling would redress this situation.
Counsel, on that point, suppose we agree with you. We remand the case back to the CCA. The CCA looks at it, decides that checkbox is okay. You come back up here, you challenge the constitutionality of it, and we say it's constitutional. Is that res judicata? Would that prevent your client from ever challenging this in a, you know, he hasn't bought a gun, he hasn't done anything yet, but would that be res judicata that would prevent your client from ever challenging the U.S. government's ability to prevent him from having a gun under 922 merely because we upheld the checkbox?
No, Your Honor, and I think that's grounded in what Congress has afforded for and the framing and relief of this issue. It's what makes the 11th Circuit case from 2017 that the government cites distinguishable. It's all about what Congress has provided an appellant to be able to do to correct an error in his record of trial, and then what that means and how that affects him, which goes to standing injury and relief ultimately from this court. So no, there should not be an issue if this court found it was constitutional, because that's what they're going, that's what the error is looking at. You're looking at the error in the record, not necessarily whether or not in the future a state or the federal government could be enjoined from prosecuting him, which is a different question and a different issue.
Chief, could I pose a question then?
Sparks.
And maybe Captain Castanian can think about this when you come back from rebuttal. For you, but what about the notion that this is all the issues regarding the consequences that might arise affecting the accused related to 922 are all collateral, but that's a collateral consequence of the court-martial. And further, you might not have, so you can answer your that question, whether or not you think I'm right or not. I'm not arguing that I am right, but I want you to think about it. And then, if that's the case, why would an error related to a collateral consequence be cognizable for the CCAs under D2?
Yes, Your Honor, would you like me to answer at this time?
No, you can wait. I mean, think about it for a minute or
Judge
two.
Sparks.
Your Honor, I have an answer now, and I'd be happy.
If you have the answer now, please. I'm waiting with bated breath.
Thank you, Your Honor. It is a collateral consequence. This court decided that in Williams, in looking at how there was no authority for the CCA to act under D1. But under D2, it's still an error in the processing of the court-martial following.
Right, but if it's an error regarding a collateral issue, why would, I guess I'm missing the connection, whether it's under D1 or D2. An error, as you are about to tell me, an error is an error, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's what's unique about what Congress has now created under 66D2. This is a new statute. There is no precedent for what the error, what excessive post-trial relief, what appropriately relief may mean, but an error under the plain language is something affecting the substantial rights of the accused or the parties. And in this case, a firearm prohibition affects him whether or not it's collateral. This court left that open in United States versus Williams in looking at what three requirements have to be raised to meet jurisdiction or authority to act under 66D2, raised by the appellant.
But I understand that, but you're using the word likely a lot, and that kind of troubles me because a lot of things are likely, but they're also unlikely. Are they not?
I think the problem with this case is that it wasn't raised at the lower court, so we don't have a factual record. We don't have the Air Force Court interpreting its own regulations. We don't have the benefit of that.
But you do know that the complaint is that I might not be able to buy a firearm and I might be prosecuted. And you're using that term, connecting it with likely. And I'm suggesting that, well, if it's likely, it may be unlikely.
I understand, Your Honor. Specialist Johnson would buy a firearm tomorrow if he could. but Nix prohibits him. So it's not, it is a fact.
Has that been determined as a matter of law? And who would determine that? Wouldn't a district court judge determine that?
Well,
if he wanted to go buy a firearm and the gun dealer said, no, you got this mark or indication on your court-martial results, I can't give you I can't sell you a weapon. So he wouldn't come back to us or the CCA, would he? He's going to be out of beyond the jurisdiction of the military at that point.
I think the hypothetical would suggest, yes, he would be outside of jurisdiction. But because Congress has provided for...
And then why would a district court judge, I know a few of them, I don't know a whole lot of them, but why would they give a hoot about what this has on his, what annotation is on his court-martial record if the judge is trying to determine whether or not 922 applies to him or not?
I think this goes back to Judge Mag's question.
It does.
About how
and Judge Hardy's question.
They're different. It's about different framing and relief. Congress has provided for correction of this error.
But has Congress provided for correction of errors that have no consequence to the accused in the military justice system?
This has enormous consequence, Your Honor.
Oh, I'm sure it does. It might. All right. In your term, it's likely.
The Air Force specifically is different from the rest of the services. Huh. For whatever reason, the Air Force does this processing after entry of judgment, which makes it fall into this narrow category of errors that occur after the entry of judgment that the appellant can raise. And that's why this case is unique. It's why the procedural posture is different. That's why remand is ultimately appropriate for Specialist Johnson's case. This is a unique feature that the Department of the Air Force has. It falls within the plain language of the statute.
Can you stand in? You've beaten me into submission, so I don't want to take up any more time. And so I'm going to ask you, if you want to continue to beat me when you come back, that's fine. But I hear your point, and it's well taken. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Barring any further questions, Your Honor?
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Castanian.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Captain Washburn.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Captain Tyler Washburn, and along with Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. This court does not have the authority to oversee all matters arguably related to military justice, per Clinton versus Goldsmith. Neither this court nor the CCA has authority to modify the firearms annotation. And before I get started, I want to take a moment to respond to a couple of appellant's points. It is not NICS that prohibits appellant from possessing a firearm. It is 18 U.S.C. 922 itself. And a collateral consequence is triggered at the moment of conviction. So at the moment that he is convicted of an offense that qualifies under 18 U.S.C. 922, appellant is already prohibited by federal law from possessing a firearm. What appellant is asking this court for is a permission slip to commit a crime. He wants the court to remove it so that he's not coded in NICS, so that he can immediately, in the words of appellant, go out and purchase a firearm. But his purchase of that firearm would be a crime because he is prohibited by 18 U.S.C. 922 by virtue of his conviction alone from possessing a firearm. Well, there's no question that this court has jurisdiction to review appellant's case. Congress has not granted this court or the CCAs the authority to act. As this court noted in Williams, CCAs do not have the authority to act on the STR. And in this case, even if this court could modify the EOJ, or if the CCA could modify it under Article 6062, which it can't, the entry of judgment would still contain the STR, which this court has already opined in Williams, cannot be touched by either the CCA or this court. And the analysis here just begins and ends with this question of whether the court has the authority to act. Pursuant to Williams, AFCA does not have authority under 66D1. So we know that that's not an avenue. When we turn and we look into Article 66D2, appellant failed to raise the issue at AFCA. And because he failed to raise the issue, the court's error correction authority was never triggered. So as it stands now, this court does not have the authority to act under that provision either. And if you look at Article 67C1B, that article also conditions this court's authority to act on the CCA's authority or having the authority to act, because it specifically states a decision, judgment, or order by a military judge as affirmed or set aside as incorrect in law by the CCA. Here, the CCA did not act because appellant didn't raise it, and even if he did, the CCA would not have the authority to correct it or to address it or to set aside or affirm it as under the law. Okay. Because it's not an error, first of all, and second, because it's not an error occurring after the entry of judgment. And I think that's an important point to discuss, because there were some questions about whether it's simultaneous because it's an endorsement to the entry of judgment. I think it's helpful to consider the entry of judgment like a contract. And a contract is not complete and final until both parties have signed the contract. Here, the EOJ is not complete or final until the first endorsement is attached with the SJA's signature, because it is a required portion of the EOJ per the RCM. And more importantly, it's important to look at Article 67C1B in relation to the rest of the statute, specifically Article 67C1A. If this court were to find that Article 67C1B grants this court carte blanche independent authority to modify any of the contents of the entry of judgment, it would render 67C1A superfluous. Because if that's the authority that Congress has vested this court with, then by that logic, the court could make modifications to any portion of the EOJ, including the findings and sentence. But yet, when Congress modified Article 67, they still saw fit to leave 67C1A in the statute, which specifically limits this court to the findings and the sentence as affirmed by the CCA. And so this court should not read 67C1B to grant such broad authority. This court should look to its own opinion in Fink, and that 67C1B granted this court authority to look at interlocutory issues raised at the trial level.
So how do you respond to Captain Castanian's point that essentially this court can and must resuscitate this case because of the constitutional issue that is lurking below, that hasn't, the accused has not had an opportunity to have that vindicated?
Well, Your Honor, I think, first of all, with regards to at least the 922 issue, appellant had the opportunity and failed to raise the issue. There is nothing that would have prohibited him or precluded him from making exactly the same arguments the appellant and Rahimi made. While in the reply brief, appellant makes a point that the national legal landscape could not foresee a successful challenge to 922, that's apparently not true, because the appellant in Rahimi did raise and make that argument. So the national legal landscape clearly did foresee the potential for a successful challenge on 922. Now, granted, Rahimi has since subsequently been overturned by the Supreme Court, and in doing so, the Supreme Court noted that firearms prohibitions similar to appellants, specifically those prohibiting felons from possessing a firearm, are presumptively constitutional. Turning next to the other constitutional point that appellant makes about United States versus Mendoza, this case does not have a Mendoza issue. The CCA clearly discussed two specific instances of touching in their opinion, one that occurred while the victim was awake, and one that began while the victim was asleep, but she did subsequently wake up while that touching was still occurring, and at that point she would have had the capacity to consent, and she did not consent. So there is no Mendoza issue raised here, simply because the facts involve some level of, sleeping does not take this outside of it. That's all circumstantial evidence that can be considered, and that's all that happened in this case. It was circumstantial evidence that the victim in that case, or this case, did not consent. So the response ultimately is none of those issues are present in this case, and so that should not cause this court any concern.
Counsel, suppose we agree with everything you say, that the CCA can't fix this and we can't fix it. Suppose there's just a clear error. How does that get fixed? I mean, are we just sort of saying, hey, that's just a gap, live with it?
Well, no, Your Honor. I think the appropriate course of action where there is a legitimate error, let's say an erroneous sex offender registration annotation is denoted, the appropriate course of conduct is to remand the case to the trial level, where the trial judge, who has been vested with the authority to issue a corrected either STR or entry of judgment, as the case were.
Well, where would you get the authority to remand it?
That is a fantastic question, Your Honor, and I think that the authority would ultimately come from the recognition that there is an error. The CCA could certainly recognize that an error has been made, but also recognizing that they don't have the authority and haven't been granted that authority by Congress, they can appropriately send the case back down to at the level where it could be addressed. But also, the Air Force does have alternate means of dealing with issues like this.
Well, could we do that in this case? Could we remand it down to the military judge and say, take another look at this?
In this case, no, Your Honor, because there is no error for the court to look at. It's not like a situation where someone's convicted of, let's say, larceny, and they've got a sex offender registration flagged on their EOJ or STR. It's very different. There is no error here. But more importantly, again, it's not an error occurring after the entry of judgment. And I think that – and I want to take a moment to discuss appellants.
Well, counsel, wait a minute. Because that would not the sex – using your own hypothetical, would not the – is not the sex registry box checked in the same manner that the 18 U.S.C. 922 box is checked? So would we not be in the same posture that your argument is that it is not occurring after the entry of judgment? I'm not trying to trip you up. I'm just
no.
I'm gonna do it, Judge Sparks. I'm not that smart. You know, I went to a public university, so it is. So I'm just trying to follow the legal logic.
No, I think that's a fair point, and in considering it, maybe there is no avenue for this court to remand, but even if there isn't, there are still avenues available to the appellant to have this remedied. One such avenue would be applying through the Air Force's internal processes to have the error corrected with,
like the Board of Military Records.
That or an expungement request. I apologize for the blank. But an expungement request, there is an expungement process in place, and I think where an error is so clear, where someone has been flagged as a sex offender for a conviction that clearly does not warrant sex offender registration, the expungement process could take care of that. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes. And then I have a follow-on, and this is – you may have been about to get into that, but appellant argues – that part of the error is that the appellant is not a convicted felon. Do you want to respond to that?
I certainly do, and my response to that is the appellant is a convicted felon. He was convicted at a GCM of a crime punishable by over a year. And even most state laws would recognize that as a felony. We cited in our brief the official code of Georgia annotated, where the code specifically includes a crime committed under the Uniform Code of Military Justice and a conviction at a court-martial such as appellant has. So even states would view this as a felony, and many other states would also prohibit appellant from possessing a firearm, which is an important point to consider for causation. Because appellant has provided no evidence to this court that he resides in a state that would not also preclude him from possessing a firearm. And where a third-party actor not before this court is also the source of the cause of the alleged injury, there is no causation. And that's an important point. But what's more important is that the appellant has not, in fact, there's nothing in the record that supports a finding of an injury. While appellant has filed a motion to attach in this case, there's nothing that specifically in the record itself that identifies an injury. But more importantly, to pivot back to another important point about post-trial processing, now, the appellant raised the issue that the error was the distribution of the EOJ after the fact. That is a collateral process that occurs based on Air Force regulation. Air Force regulation requires the EOJ, the SDR, as well as an Air Force Form 177 to be processed and distributed to ensure the government's compliance with federal firearm restriction reporting requirements. That is a collateral process that is outside of this court's authority to act on in light of Clinton v. Goldsmith. Because while this court does have significant authority over a lot of issues with regards to matters of military justice, this court does not have the ability to police the regulations that are in place and set by the secretaries of the respective branches. Lastly, I want to really address the prudential analysis, because as this court noted in BM, we adhere to the standing doctrine as well as the rightness and mootness doctrines. And it's important to recognize that appellant has not established standing in this case. He has no standing to raise this issue. One, because he has not established an injury, at least based on the face of the record itself. Two, because there's no causation. As I already discussed, there's the potential implications of third-party actors, but also because it's not the firearms annotation that prohibits appellant from possessing a firearm. It's 18 U.S.C. 922 itself. An appellant cited to Range in their initial brief saying that the injury is the same. But there's a key distinction between appellant's case and the appellant in Range. The appellant in Range recognized that the actual cause of the injury was the statute, not a firearms annotation. He didn't challenge, the reporting requirements of the civilian authorities and how he got processed into NICS. You have to look for causation. You have to look at what is actually prohibiting him. What makes it illegal for appellant to possess a firearm, and it's not the firearm annotation. It's by virtue of his conviction alone that 18 U.S.C. 922 applies. But moving past that, it also speaks to redressability, because even if this court could modify the EOJ and remove the firearms restriction, appellant's criminal record would still show that he was convicted of a felony. And if he were arrested by either state officials or federal officials, he could still be prosecuted for violating 18 U.S.C. 922. He was advised on the record by the military judge that the maximum sentence in his case exceeded 1 year. That is potentially enough to satisfy the knowledge requirement for violation of 18 U.S.C. 922. And this court, neither this court nor the CCAs have the authority to enjoin federal authorities from enforcing 18 U.S.C. 922, nor do they have the authority to prohibit state actors or state authorities from enforcing their respective state laws with regards to firearm prohibitions relating to felonies. And if I may have one moment, this court should find that it lacks the authority to modify the firearms annotation on the entry of judgment. It is not the source of the prohibition, nor does this court have the authority to preclude the enforcement of 18 U.S.C. 922. If there are no further questions.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Washburn.
Thank you.
Captain Castani.
Your Honor, I have 3 points, and I would like to start with Chief Judge Olson, your question about whether or not this court has remanded previously for an issue that had not been raised. Requesting to cite a supplemental authority, which is United States versus Inong, I-N-O-N-G, 58 MJ, 460, 460, 2003. And in that case, it was an issue of illegal pretrial punishment. This court set aside the decision of the lower court and remanded the case to that court to consider this question initially and to take remedial action if necessary. It's important to recognize that if the firearm prohibition is adjudicated at the Air Force Court, it moots this issue for this court, which is why it's important to remand for Specialist Johnson to show good cause, why this issue wasn't raised in the first place, and let the Air Force Court adjudicate it. This goes to my second point about United States versus Mendoza. There is a Mendoza issue in this case. It's very clear that the government argued two separate theories of liability, one that was charged and one that was not charged. One that happened in the kitchen when the named victim was awake, and one that happened when the named victim was asleep. The government took advantage of prior Mendoza precedent and was able to argue both. Whether or not this conviction is legally or factually sufficient, there is a due process issue that the Air Force Court has to tackle. That also is a mootness concern for the firearm prohibition, because if there's no conviction, if the government's argument is correct, there's no firearm prohibition. And this case should be remanded for Specialist Johnson to receive the benefit of United States versus Mendoza. The third point is this court, Judge Maggs, you asked hypothetically if this was a more legitimate error rather than an error that has to be adjudicated. Specialist Johnson is a felon. The question is whether or not he's a violent felon, and therefore the Second Amendment applies. But for a case, for example, like Dominguez-Garcia, which is talked about in our reply brief, she does not qualify under the statute, period. She was convicted of a special court martial. That is a punishable confinement cap of 1 year. The CFR recognizes that she shouldn't be under NICS and she could not be prosecuted under 18 U.S.C. That is an error in post-trial processing for checking the box for her. This court has two options. It can act on the endorsement itself under RCM 1111, the entry of judgment because the endorsement is in the entry of judgment under RCM 1111, or under RCM 1112, a superior competent authority, which would include this court, can remand the case back to the trial judge. There is authority for this court to do so, which is why this case should ultimately be remanded and Specialist Johnson should receive the benefit of both Williams and Mendoza.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:30.
The court stands in recess until 10:30.